Right, the kind of doubts around the 42.
Okay. Yeah, we stopped at 142 Sputnik.
We went on to the next page.
143 and 144. I said, save that for the book.
Reopen.
What did you say, save for the book?
Well, 143 and 144, what's in there is in this book in chapter 31.
Okay.
There's some things, though, that I want to mention and then I want to read from. And then we'll move on to 145. Have you heard of Levittown?
Yes.
Wait.
Probably in the Billy Joel song, right?
Never mind.
What was the name?
Levittown, where he was born, in fact.
Billy Joel was the Billy Joel song.
That's also another one, yeah. Billy Joel was born in Long Island in the original Levittown. Well, Levittown, you know. Here's pronounceable phrase.
Oh, yeah.
Here is a picture of what it's looking like.
What
page is that on?
This is on page 4. I can't read it. 988, maybe?
it's
that's a Bible.
It's like a housing complex.
That's far.
Right? My manufactured neighborhood?
Yep, prefab duplicated homes. Not exactly the same, but somewhat mindful of. You know where North O Harps is?
Mm-hmm.
And that neighborhood in there where all the streets are named for World War II generals, MacArthur and Morris and things?
Oh, yeah, over at the Brigham.
Okay, those areas are, you know, like one or two, three style homes repeated over and over and over.
Oh, yeah.
Those were an example of what we're talking about. That is, right after World War II, the creation of prefab homes that are very cheap to make, but finally possible for young people, especially war veterans and their new brides coming out of World War II, to own their own homes. Here's usually the things that are associated with it. It was the brainchild of this William Levitt, who made the first of these. Are you freezing? William Levitt, who made the first of these housing developments in Long Island, New York, and it caught on because they were so inexpensive to make and they made it possible for so many people to be in home ownership. The degree of home ownership is a real telling of how prosperous a society is rather than always just renting or public housing. And so what we're saying is that I want to kind of come back and say that what were some of the purposes, plural, behind the GI Bill and the slow mustering of people out of the military after World War II?
To prevent a surplus of labor and then to educate them so they don't go straight to factory jobs.
And therefore, what would be protected?
From a depression, normally.
Have there been any depressions lately?
What years? Yeah.
The whole 30s.
Yeah.
In fact, the only reason you could say why was the mid-40s not depression-laden?
War boost economy.
Artificial spending, right?
Mm-hmm.
War boost.
So could we forever stay on government surplus deficit?
Always in war.
Well, mm-hmm. That's going to be part of our second
answer.
So if we're going to convert back to peacetime, they're doing not completely. They're going to try to do it, as you just pointed out, and just muster people back as slow as possible so the economy can absorb them so they don't fall back into a depression. But there's a second.
Last time I checked, Raytheon is still here.
Pardon?
Last time I checked, Raytheon is still here.
Where have I heard of Raytheon?
They're a defense contractor.
Oh, okay, that's bad. Yeah, I'll be upon all those things growing this time period. So it's to protect the economy from falling apart, but also there is the awareness. What had been our behavior after World War I? It's not that behavior.
Just go right back to peacetime economy.
Completely, yeah. Dismount your troops. Everybody comes out of the military.
Just celebrate time.
So the thinking is, should we in 45 go back to full demobilization?
No, especially with the Soviet Red Scare.
Yeah, the way the 30s and 20s unfolded, the feeling that we had been too naive and not been ready for the threat of Nazism made us feel like after the Pearl Harbor attack that we never can truly be demobilized, that we have to be much more standing military for defense. And, of course, there was an immediate threat. It wasn't just potential. It was the Reds, the Soviets. So with the Soviet threat in Eastern Europe, there is reason to keep some of the military going, not only just for the economic picture. So part of this formula to try to make sure that the prosperity comes back in better is to make affordable housing. And when the Levittown idea works in Long Island, it catches on all over America. I was born and raised in one in California. San Lorenzo. Pardon?
What was it like? Levittown? Was it like Dennis the Menace?
Oh, yeah.
perfectly cut line,
like
you imagine.
Yeah, you bet. Well, no, that's kind of upscale from where I started. But then it's diminished things, the upper middle class.
Oh, okay.
These prefab homes were very, very small kitchens, if possible, even three bedrooms, usually two bedrooms. But the point was, and first of all, the criticism of these homes were they looked alike so much that, and people seemed to fall under the pressure in the 50s of dressing alike, thinking alike. There's a lot of criticism, in fact, making fun of society as being so conformist. That's part of the beatnik reaction. And so these homes, when you look back at them now, people tended to be ridiculed them as being like making all robotic people. But the other side of that issue is, for the first time, a majority of Americans were truly able to, in the urban areas, own their own homes. And home ownership is such a strong element for the economy and for stability of the family. And so making them that cheap made it possible for people to be in their own homes. And that's what happened in these circles here in Fort Smith and all across America.
What does that mean today? Home resale value is dropped the first time ever. So why is that happening?
Because it was such a runaway boom in prices that shouldn't have been. I'll use a stock market explanation that brokers always use when things go down. It's a market correction.
Okay.
Otherwise, the prices all bubbled up and then eventually the bubble
burst. Yeah.
So
Levi's Hand is part of this 50. And also, it's this, if you have more and more people with more and more money who can get into homes, and the husbands are coming back to the wives they've missed, what's also going to happen?
Baby boom.
Like me. Born in 52. So from 1947 to about 1959 or 60 is called the baby boom generation.
Now these fabricated homes, they did have thick walls. And moving. That was so funny.
Probably not picking up.
I'll tell you later.
So that's one of the parts of this chapter that if you'll read about that, the crabgrass frontier, as they call it, in terms of suburban growth. Here's more about the Great Black Migration, and it talks about in here about this struggle for home ownership in northern cities. Of course, this cartoon, which was also in the Onion, but we won't cite why, is about whom? And what does he do?
Wait, is that on yet?
Which?
This is on.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, the article was general.
In the Onion, that is what did occur. But in reality, what's that a player?
The first African American
to be
professional baseball major league.
And in the MLB.
And
was
how
like
was he received?
Sort of betrayed his race. They betrayed him.
It's interesting that you say it because while African Americans were excited about the idea of more and more equal opportunity and equality in society, they also saw what happens to the Negro Leagues. Will they fall apart? Same kind of fear occurs when they start integrating colleges. What will happen to historic black colleges? There is that fear that things that were established for the purpose will lose their purpose once integration is possible. But
they did.
They did, yeah. But let's kind of think, let's demarcate from 1941 on, if we can, things involving slow but gradual evolution of civil rights for African Americans. First in 41 is the desegregation of the defense plans. What would be next?
Desegregation of the armed forces under Truman.
That's 1948. And of course, this is actually a year earlier, the hiring of him. But crowds in the Brooklyn Stadium were very, very uncomfortable with him. Teammates didn't want anyone playing with him. But the one thing that made it work was what?
He was
so good. He could help him win. And so eventually Satchel Paige and others came in, and they all began to desegregate because of the quality and ability.
I think Paige could catch the air on fire. I don't like you.
That's true.
So that's the desegregation in the 40s. In the early 50s will become, which we will talk about soon, we have not yet. It's on the next page. Brown toes, not before you. So anytime in our discussions you see benchmarks or milestones where something about civil rights or women's rights take place, keep up with that, because what your best preparation between now and the test is, can you think of 5 bullet points on so-and-so? Can you think of a 7-part outline on so-and-so? Can you think of a thesis to tie it all together? The more you can keep that together, the better you'll be ready for any question you get. And minority questions are always high yield. Role of women. I get a kick out of reading this just because it pisses people off. Sorry, Tate. But only the next, right? bigots, forgive me right next. Didn't mean to call you right next. Women's place. Increasing conformity in middle class business and corporate life is mirrored in the middle class home. But in fact, let me read the original because it's even better. This is the brief edition. Let me find the.
What is the non-brief edition?
Well, the brief edition is about 1,000 pages long. If you use the Kindle that's non-brief, which is in two parts,
read that.
It is about 1,500 pages long. So sometimes quotes are better.
Oh, okay, man.
So it's brief. It's only 500 pages.
Two quotes that are 1,000 pages long.
My name is Angela. Remember one of those sample essays we had that said assess life in the 50s and consumer culture was one of the choices? There's a couple of good pages in here about how much consumerism arose, the ability to buy, the buying power, and what impact it had on not just the economy but also way of living. Do you have that book memorized?
No, not at all.
I'm just wondering.
All right, I found it already.
Actually,
they show this Thunderbird car and call it Mint Coat for Father, an advertisement for Ford Thunderbird claims what a mint coat does to perk up a lady, a Thunderbird does for a male.
Is that the first time? I mean, that's about looks now. The Thunderbird is about affording a...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It is a keep up with the Joneses, conspicuous consumption, purposefulness.
That.
Yeah, it is. That's what it is. Well, this isn't what I was looking at, but listen to this. The return of some 15 million soldiers to private life helped generate a post-war baby boom which peaked in 1957. Between 1945 and 60, America's total population grew almost 40 million, an increase of almost 30%. Large families were back in style. When asked why he wanted six children, a Harvard senior replied that it was a minimum production goal. Much of America's social...
Oh, my God!
Much of America's social history since the 1940s has been the story of unusually large baby boom generations and its progress through stages of life.
This is also the return of conservatism and anti-contraception.
Yes, yes it is. Yes, it is.
This is also when college wasn't a fortune.
Mm-hmm. The initial effect of the baby boom generation is to create a massive demand for diapers, baby food, toys, medicine, schools, books, teachers, and housing. By the way, while we're at it, here's a figure who will appear sometimes on the AP test. He got his start in the 50s and died just about a decade ago. You ever heard of Benjamin Spock?
Yeah.
Not
my
the Star Trek.
My mom still
reads Dr. Spock.
I know. But
the Child and Baby Care book by Dr. Spock.
That's it.
That ends up being one of the ones. Is that on our sheet here? It should be if it's not. Yeah, it's on the number 145. That comes to the sound board. I need to check these. We're going to really like this.
They heard it.
Women's place. Okay. That's a good one here.
Okay.
Increasing conformity in the middle class workplace was mirrored in the middle class home. A special issue of Life magazine published in 1956 featured the ideal middle class woman. A 32-year-old pretty and popular suburban housewife, mother of four, who had married at age 16. She was described as an excellent wife, mother, hostess, volunteer, home manager. Made her own clothes, hosted dozens of dinner parties each year, sang in the church choir, worked in the school PTA and campfire girls, and was devoted to her husband.
Gag me.
What is that movie?
Who's in it?
What?
Yeah, Suburban.
Which one?
That's for a while.
Oh, I haven't seen it.
This
kind of
goes back to the conservatism reform cycle.
Oh.
Don't watch them.
Does kind of go back to the conservatism reform cycle.
Jesus,
of which one?
The reform war conservatism.
Yes, it does. Very much as you're saying is if you think, here's the parallel. If progressivism is a reform, moves from being domestic to worldwide through World War I's crusade to make the world safe for democracy, and then falls back into the retrenchment conservative 1920s, then make the same formula from a New Deal reform movement that turns into make the world safe for democracy against Nazis World War II and struggle against communism back into the conservative 50s.
And then the Great 60s. Society, Vietnam.
And you have, if you follow these cycles, the 60s for civil rights and reform ends up being a war against communism worldwide in the 70s and finally lapses back into the Watergate disgust and back into a conservative 80s Reagan period. So they're not perfect, but they're cycles.
And reform under Clinton and war on terror.
We wish.
Huh?
No, it's just Reaganism hasn't stopped.
God.
Back to this.
Reaganism continues.
In her daily round, Life reported, she attends club or charity meetings, drives the children to school, does the weekly grocery shopping, makes ceramics, and is planning to study French. She also exercises on the trampoline in order to keep her size 12 figure.
Is that the soccer mom?
Yes.
That's true. We have soccer moms today.
It gets better here. Life's description of the American middle-class woman was a symptomatic of a veritable cult of feminine domesticity. Where have we heard that phrase before?
It was by the Fuller. Beecher.
Catherine Beecher. Catherine Elizabeth Beecher.
And she wrote the Cult of Domesticity,
right. So it's there's...
I just read that in Kindle, and it was lectured twice.
Yep. A cult of feminine domesticity that developed in the post-war era. The soaring birth rates reinforced the deeply embedded notion that a woman's place was in the home as the tender of the hearth and guardian of the children. Of all the accomplishments of the American woman, the Life cover story proclaimed, the one she brings off with most spectacular success is having babies.
That kind of sounds like the Fisher quote.
So listen to this follow-up comment.
This was in Life?
Mm-hmm.
1957. Does this make you think of a Fisher quote, barefoot and pregnant?
Did he say that?
He said that all the time.
Only quoting it, right?
Yeah.
Thus, even though millions of women who had responded to intense wartime appeals and joined Rosie the Riveter with one E and the traditional male workforce, afterward they were encouraged and even forced to turn their jobs over to returning veterans and assume their full-time commitment to home and family. A 1945 article in House Beautiful entitled Home Should Be Even More Wonderful Than He Remembers It lectured women on their post-war responsibilities. The returning veteran is head man again. Your part in remaking this man is to fit his home to him, understanding why he wants it this way, forgetting your own preferences.
I have a question.
Give me my cereal.
A little bit more. This is getting better here. Hold on. Women were also to forget wartime-generated thoughts of their own career in the workplace. Back to the kitchen was the repeated refrain. Women must boldly announce, a Barnard College trustee asserted in 1950, that no job is more exacting, more necessary, more rewarding than that of housewife and mother. She then, the author of this article, pleaded, God protect us from all those efficient go-getter businesswomen whose feminine instincts have been completely sterilized. Isn't that great? Didn't it work like I said it would?
I wish they would ask me a question like that on the AP.
They will.
And I'll just let them. Yeah, just
a little bit more, just a little bit more than your question. Many, perhaps most women agreed. A housewife who was married at the end of the war and had her first child in 1947,
my dad,
declared in Atlantic Monthly, we like this business. This is the women speaking, supposedly. We like this business of running a home after a few years of contemplating what life would be like without our husbands. When a woman writing in the same magazine called for government-supported nurseries so as to allow mothers more time for self-culture and careers outside a home, a female reader replied that such a proposal invokes shades of communism. And any plan which even seems related to communism already has two strikes against it.
Well, actually, if you think about it, that would be kind of communist.
Everyone works.
Is the government taking the role of the mother in instilling social values?
That's the argument. When was Under God added to the pledge?
54.
Right in the middle of this thing.
It was designed to combat communism.
It was exactly because the atheist Marxists were non-religious. And Eisenhower wanted in Congress passed something that would emphasize that the pledge is not just about Americanism, but Christian Americanism.
Would that ever be removed?
The Congress could just repeal it.
The communists could repeal
it? The Congress.
Oh.
You said communists.
You said communists.
Well,
that's a Freudian slip right there.
He's capitalist.
Did I say communist?
Yes.
In response to that,
I heard Congress too, because I was saying
the closest we've come to that so far, and you get some indication of what's happening here, is the Michael Newdow case. No, Michael Newdow is a father in California whose daughter was hearing, I guess, compelled to hear in the same atmosphere of the pledge each day, and he argued that that was an unconstitutional establishment of religion.
But don't you just love the Supreme Court decision?
Yeah, I'm going to tell you.
We're not going to sound the case, but you just don't have the right to.
Stealing that first time. But that he fought it through the courts saying that it was unconstitutional for her to be compelled to be in the atmosphere of the establishment of religion, that the prayer aspects of the pledge, which is why I say that every day, second period, tell everybody to stand for the prayer. And the court finally addressed it in what way?
You don't have the right to sue.
Yeah, that's right. Since the mother has custody, you don't have the right to sue.
I think you should sue for...
So why would the court take that position? Why didn't they
have... I don't want to touch it.
Yeah. Well, let's think about that for a second.
But it's the Supreme Court. They
if the court
fired.
Felt firmly that it's legal to do so, why didn't they just say that's not a violation, don't bring this case back again because it's legal to do so?
They knew that there was no
if they don't believe that it's really legal, then why didn't they rule the other way? So
because there's such huge popular support for it.
It would be unenforceable at that
they
point.
They have no constituents.
So therefore, tell us something about, take it out of the pledge. Take it out of the pledge and put it back in race relations. When these suits in the late 40s and early 50s get started, not just the Brown case, but there are many school suits, there's housing suits, there's lots of civil rights discrimination suits going into federal courts and working their way towards the Supreme Court, what's the court's thinking on this?
That we better be unanimous on this.
Well, I think they know that if a correct reading of the law says you cannot discriminate on the basis of race. It is clearly a violation of the 14th Amendment. But the majority of the American public is still so racist.
Would
that be judicial activism? And then that's what they're also against.
It'd be judicial activism not to do it?
No, I mean to do it. But to say
well,
one way or the other.
If the decision had been discrimination in public schools violates the 14th Amendment, that's it, nothing else said, somebody else has to fix it like a Congress or something, that would have been not judicial activism, that would have been interpretation. But when they added in Brown 2 a year later that public schools must desegregate with all deliberate speed, now they're going into activism. And when they start demanding, of course in the 60s, they start court-ordered busing. That's totally like making laws from the bench. That's activism. And so that's why I'm saying, why did it took till 1954? There were cases going on in the 40s, but finally by 54, the court got the courage to really stand up and pass down a ruling that they knew was not going to be popular.
Have you seen the movie Separate but Equal?
Yes, it's long but it's good.
I had it ripped onto my computer, so I burned
it to
DVD
for
Fisher.
Yeah. I've got it. With Sidney Poitier playing Thurgood Marshall.
Yeah.
And Burt Lancaster is playing John W. Davis.
Well, I had originally fed the VHS into the computer to save as DVD, but I don't have the files anymore.
Do you want a copy of it?
Sure.
The copyright infringement people are listening.
We will buy one from the store for you.
Okay. We'll purchase a license from Columbia Records to copy it.
Just in case where we've deviated for a second gets on to the test. If the court was so guarded against handing down civil rights decisions, why did it do so in 1954?
What was the name of that case?
Brown versus the Board of Topeka, Kansas Education.
Okay. How about the one about the Pledge of Allegiance? What was that one called? That's what I was
saying. You know, with the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. Newdow versus the universe, I don't know what the new one is. I don't know what
Newdow
is. Michael Newdow.
I don't think I'll be in there.
It was something about, it
like
was like
2 years
Newdow
ago.
Versus California.
The school system
or
something like that.
Yeah. Whatever.
That post was like 2 years ago. It's not.
But that's the one I was talking about. That would have been the system which they're all like.
If they had ruled. They would
say my name out loud.
Could that be another reason they didn't touch it?
The conservatives would scream that, but it wouldn't be.
Right. I mean, are you saying, was that like...
let's give you an example of where they would scream judicial activism. It just wouldn't be. Let's say that the court said the only reason you have the right to own a gun is if when you participate in militia activities. Now, that would infuriate people. But it wouldn't be judicial activism. It'd be judicial restraint, I would argue. It'd be strict constructionism, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's what that amendment says. It doesn't say you can shoot grandma and cans and rabbits. It says function in the militia.
Grandma. Well, no, it's kind of ambiguous on that one.
It's not ambiguous. There is a prelude.
Except
the First Amendment doesn't say because our government may need to be in control or check for its dangerous
no, it
control,
comma,
you have free speech. It just says you have free speech. It says you have free speech for no reason at all, but the guns have a reason.
But we don't have any, we're not the interpreters.
We the citizens do not have the right to speak freely about
No, we don't get to make the law.
Right. So the people you vote for president who appoint those judges.
That's how, well, you get to, then you do make the laws that way.
Although they do have that layer of
ice. Not that I will read in great details at you or to you. Are we running out of time?
5:15.
We're here forever, though, right?
Actually,
I'm here to 6 because yeah. I don't have a ride.
Okay, you're here to 6 then. Yeah. Okay, well, but let me get you through into the next sheet. The rest of this chapter also has about 2 good pages on the upsurge of religious faith. It's a very, very big upsurge in religious faith in the 1950s, and it's worth looking at. And then the literature and the drama of the time period both mirrors the conformity and sometimes the kind of loss of purpose, but at the same time criticizes it, and that's what works.
Are you going by that one?
Both of them. This one's the...
That has that stuff you're talking about now?
This has it, but in shorter verse.
Oh.
Chapter 39.
Yeah. And that's what 143 and 144 is about. And it's also what the next one on 145 is about. Those books are, they are the popular 50s books. The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, I believe, is, that's the one that talks about the stifling conformity of culture. So is David Reisman's The Lonely Crowd. It's not a fiction work, though. It is a nonfiction assessment of society. Power of Positive Thinking and How to Win Friends and Influence People. These are great books. Those are really good books. Very encouraging. Written by Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie, respectively.
Do you want a copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People?
Yes.
Yeah.
Found an original in the estate sale books ago.
We'd love to have that one. These artists of the original Ashcan School, now like Hopper, are part of the Abstract Expressionist movement. They asked, here's what they had on the test one time. They had pictures of Mao or Marilyn Monroe, I think it was Mao, repeated in different colors and shades. And then they asked...
Easily.
I don't think they ask who it's by. They ask what movement did it represent.
Hoppard?
Yeah, by Warhol, right?
That was an AP U.S. history question.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in color?
No, it was in shaded black and white. If you have an interest in arts and culture, you're going to be rewarded on this test.
Yeah.
In fact, lots of times, the questions of the 70s and 80s and 90s are less foreign policy and political elections, and it's more like cultural, artistic things.
Probably didn't want to be accused of
these names here in 146 represent not the only, but some of the better known of the Beatnik movement. If you visit San Francisco, you need to go to the corner of Grant and Columbus, where there is a bookstore called City Lights Bookstore. It's the first professional paperback bookstore in America, all paperback books. Set up by Lawrence Ferlinghetti. It is the epitome of the left coast California image that everybody has of it. The section on American history is called Stolen Continents. That's what they call it.
Whoa.
Are they good books or are they all?
They're all left leaning.
It's in a section called Stolen Continents. That's the left leaning.
They're good books.
Oh.
What's the military history section entitled?
You know,
is the tape running?
Yeah.
Okay.
I bet there are right.
Are these? If that's the essay that comes up, we're ready for it. 147. We talked about this before. Let's mention this. The Interstate. This comes up. The Interstate Highway Act of 1956, signed into law by Eisenhower. It has multiple purposes. What does it do?
And it creates a nationwide transport system.
Yeah. The interstate highway systems we have today that connect the states were built by this money. Not by state money. Well, it was actually state money. It was matching funds of state and federal money.
It was one of the early examples of block grants.
Mm-hmm. And in addition to making commerce grow, it also had what dual potential purpose?
The military transport system.
So that planes could land on straight highways.
any transport truck.
Remember when my child with his eye drove all the way through Wyoming and Utah and all that? I was so worried he'd be like on these cliffs and everything. He said the road lived up to the legend that it mainly very straight things and very few curves.
I've driven out to Wyoming.
On the interstate, so.
But that's the reason why you invite so easy to fall.
So thank those Soviets for threatening us, or otherwise you'd had a more dangerous ride.
They say that's why it's so easy to fall asleep on the interstates because they're so straight. It's on like the Autobahn and they're so curved you can't fall asleep.
Two other things that come out. Sometimes I just type stuff because it comes to my memory. This is a decade later.
I have to eat.
Unsafe at any speed.
The book Unsafe at Any Speed, written in 1966. Yes, what is this book about?
About the cars being very unsafe.
I think specifically the Corvair.
Yeah.
The Corvair had a gas tank that if nudged from the rear blew up.
What?
Wait, I thought it took your left blinkers
on.
Was it that? I thought if it was it an electrical car?
You had to have a blinker on and be hitting it from the rear.
Sorry, I wasn't exactly there.
No problem.
It's like the combination of
actually, no, that may not be correct.
What did that lead to?
Safety
standards on car building. Consumer safety standards, not just in automobiles, but in all different areas.
Never mind, that's something.
And that's how Ralph Nader, who's still alive today, as you know. He's
a
Palestinian Arab.
No.
His parents were. He's an American-born Palestinian Arab.
I didn't know
that. Oh, what?
Is that why he'll never win?
He's
American-born, but his family's from Palestine.
Okay.
No, I know.
Okay.
Just trying to get you to slam
the desk. So this book began the consumer safety watch-type movement for consumer protectionism. And, of course, it's not surprising, therefore, he would have been, for a while, the darling of the Green Party, because in addition to environmentalism, what does the Green Party focus on?
Safety
standards and pollution and things of that nature, which would stem from this book. There is another book by another author, which is somewhat in this vein, called Silent Spring by Rachel Carson, written in 1962. She also wrote a book called The Sea Around Us, but the Silent Spring is the famous one. What's it about?
DDT.
Yeah, the dangers of pesticides. 148. This is what we've been flirting with before, and here we are.
Even though you already shouldn't have it.
That was just a teaser. The Brown case. Linda Brown lived in Topeka, Kansas. She was like within minutes walk from a white school, or she could take the 2-hour bus ride to the black school, or there wasn't a black school. I think there was one that would accept her, but it really was going out of business because it didn't get enough people. So in essence, she wasn't able to go to school. And that was one of many cases coming out of southern states also where people were, the NAACP specifically, National Association of Colored Persons, wanted to sue on the grounds of one of two directions. Either make Plessy be enforced or overturn Plessy. What do you mean by making Plessy be enforced?
Separate but equal. They'd have to provide equal facilities.
That's it. They'd have to argue to truly create schools that were within travel distance, that had equal facilities, teachers, books, et cetera, desks, and things that were of equal quality. If they're not going to do that, then let the schools be integrated. If they could have their way, they'd go for the integration rather than the equal schools. But if they couldn't win the integration fight because it was just too much of a change of social attitudes, they wanted the equal funding. It is Thurgood Marshall who said, we shouldn't go for halfway measures. We really need to desegregate all the school systems and end separate but equal. And so he said, it's worth the risk of not even getting anything to fight the good fight for the top battle. And so he leads this fight in the case. And in the 49, 15, 51, 52 period, they're just languishing along trying to get into the Supreme Court. And at that point, the Supreme Court is still under the leadership of Fred Vinson. But Fred, when the 52 election happens,
is Marshall an attorney?
He was lead attorney for the NAACP. And the 52 election, who wins? And what's one of the reasons that Eisenhower and his vice president of California running Nixon win?
Because Warren promised
him. Earl Warren, governor of California, the same one that signed the order to put the Japanese Americans in camps. Earl Warren made a deal with Eisenhower that if I can turn the state's vote your way, I get the first opening on the Supreme Court. and it occurs that Fred Benson, the Chief Justice, dies. And so,
has Hall known about this before Benson died?
I would bet not. I bet that's a secret arrangement made. I mean, it didn't stay secret, obviously, but I don't know. I would think not.
Well, Earl Warren's what?
Governor of California.
Okay.
So Vincent dies, and Warren's back for his job. And Eisenhower says, well, we didn't expect you to be the Chief Justice. Why don't we elevate one of the sitting justices, and you take his spot until you get some experience? And he goes, a deal's a deal. I want the Chief Justice spot. And so Eisenhower honored it, and here's a man who had never been on any courts at all. He was made Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Harry Potter.
And what
is that more livable?
And to, yes, the Eisenhower quote about the appointment of Earl Warren, biggest damn fool mistake I ever made in my life. What he never expected was how liberal Warren went. He had been a fairly conservative governor of California.
What's conservative in California?
That's a good point. There is actually a case that we studied this summer at Stanford, a California case that involved the same issue concerning Mexican Americans that were not allowed to go to school with white in Southern California, called Westminster versus Mendez. And
this is an old case?
This is an old case of about 1947-48, but Warren had shown support for the Mexican-American community and the outcome of that case. So it wasn't that big of a surprise how he turned out. Eisenhower should have, if he'd known him for that case, that when it came to the issue of equal rights for minorities, that Warren was already drifting in that condition. But what they didn't really expect for was him to take this case, bring it up, and start to run with it and start to arm wrestle everybody else on the court. He went from person to person and said, we need to finally overturn Plessy. We need to make it clear that separate is inherently unequal. That's the only way we can right the wrongs of racism for the century. I mean, we need it to be a 9-0 decision, not a 5-4, not a 7-2.
This is on the ODA thing.
Mm. So if we have a split decision, there'll be arguments from different sectors that the courts, like you're saying, judicial activists. But if it's 9-0 in favor of overturning, there can be no argument against it. And he had to work quite hard at it, but he succeeded. So the case is Here's an interesting thing about it. When the Plessy case was passed, the ruling there was 8-1. 8 in favor of separate but equal, 8 opposed. The one who opposed was whom? Harlan. John Marshall Harlan. And John Marshall Harlan, in his dissent in 1896, said, separate is inherently unequal. It can never be legal or fair and proper. And that was the phrase they used to do the reversal, so that all 9-0 took the Harlan position. And, of course, what's interesting is the grandson of John Marshall Harlan, who was also named John Marshall Harlan, was one of the 9 judges in 1954 that helped do the reversal.
Wow.
Oh, that's kind of neat stuff. So sometimes, you know, you think of the mystic turns of fate. If Fred Benson hadn't died when he did, would this case have been never, or would it be a few years later under somebody else? But
probably been delayed until the 60s or 70s.
Would it happened anyway?
Have to have confidence in it.
Yeah. And of course, then what? If I jump over 149 for a second, I'll come back to the rest of what's in there. And go to 150. The first test of the Brown case is going to be here in Arkansas, the Central High affair.
Uh-oh.
And
who was it? Billy Joel.
Billy Joel, yeah. And we didn't start the fire song.
No.
you heard that story, right?
Yeah.
I'm pretty.
And so you already know the whole story of what happened to Central High and Favis and Eisenhower and all that. You don't need to hear that again.
Maybe we're happy that a racist governor.
We're okay on that story.
Is there something named after Favis?
Pardon?
Isn't there something named after Favis?
Probably. But if you're not familiar with the Brown case, then read about it.
Didn't he reverse his stance before you died?
Central. No. Oh, no,
the governor.
Oh, you mean Favis. I thought you meant Warren. Favis, it's funny you mention that. One person who really truly did very overtly and honestly was George Wallace, the guy that said segregation now, segregation tomorrow and forever. After being shot, he became very aware of what he'd done. Yeah. He reversed his own. Favis claimed all along, then and later, that he was never a racist. but that he did what he did to protect the majority of his constituents wishing to keep the peace.
Even when the National Guard was coming in?
Well, he was arguing that wasn't his fault, that was interfering Northern Yankees. Here's something that ought to take Eisenhower down a peg. I shouldn't say this. I read this in Halberstam's book. Did you know David Halberstam? Have you heard of him?
No.
David Halberstam is an author who just died 2 or 3 days ago in a car accident in California.
Oh, I heard that.
Real significant author.
How did he die?
He's a passenger in a car crash.
Oh, he's passenger.
By the Gunnell Park's right next door to Stanford's. Where
was he buckled?
But in his book, The 50s, he describes how when. Do you have the book?
Mitchell does.
Oh. Well, you can go see this, see if I'm telling the truth, because it's been years since I remember reading it.
Is it The 50s or?
The 50s, dark blue cover.
Maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
And anyway, in the book, he describes Faubus being called to meet with Eisenhower, and Eisenhower is trying his best to, you know, reach Faubus in a way that doesn't have to be confrontational. And so what he says is, I understand what you're thinking, and I have the same feeling that I'm not comfortable with big black bucks sitting next to little white girls in school classes. But it's the law, and we gotta let them.
Was that what he felt?
No.
That's what he told Faubus.
Now, who said he said that?
David Halberstam, the author.
The author. And who told the author?
Well, you'd have to look at the footnote.
Was he there?
You'd have to look at the footnote at the end of the chapter.
Yeah, maybe it was
I'm just saying. Quoting the book. Now, before you get too down on conservative Republican Dwight D. Eisenhower for that comment, let me say this. Can you think of another time in history ever when a president stood up to a state and said, no, you will not deny people their equality, I'll send the military otherwise? Now,
nullification, but not equality.
Didn't we have equality? Jackson wanted to send the military, but not for equality.
But, you know, that's why I always say when you're studying 2 centuries ago or a century ago or even 50, 60 years ago and you see these kind of comments and attitudes that are so shockingly racist or insensitive, take into account that that's probably the majority of the people living at the time thinking. As it gets closer to our current times, it's not. But it is, you know, a century ago easily in the 1920s and 30s. I mean, don't you think, I'm getting way off on a tangent here, but I'm just doing a hypothetical here, but 100 years from now, 200 years from now, the gay bashing that goes on in America will be looked at with the same kind of shock. And for us, we're used to it every day. Well, that's just so-and-so, don't mind him. You know.
That's just people, though. There aren't, there are ones.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's
those are crazy.
The understanding of the times.
I'm talking about the people.
I have a little bit of a Halberstam story for you. I know you don't want to be held too long. And I shouldn't put this on tape, but I will anyway. A little David Halberstam story. He became well known as a journalist reporting the war in Vietnam back in the 60s. He's one of those original reporters that found that what the military was giving at the press conferences were not accurate with what he saw in the fields. That's why the press has been so muzzled in recent wars.
But when he first went there, he didn't want to report it. Like he wanted them to be successful, though.
I think most reporters coming out of the World War II tradition wanted to support a positive image of our military. And when in Vietnam they found these just gross inaccuracies and misrepresentations, they started reporting the truth, and that put them on a battle stage with the military. And then they got lied to even more, and they became very cynical. He wrote about it in a book called The Best and the Brightest. And there's another book he wrote about Vietnam. Well, because he wrote so much about Vietnam, this is really not what you need to know for the AP test, it's just a personal story here. When I went to work on my master's thesis in the early 80s, I had gathered all my material and was got the research ready and ready to dig through, and I needed some kind of central idea to put this through. I needed a thesis to build all this around. So after reading some of his book, I thought, this guy is who I should contact. What would happen if I just find out from the publishing company where he lives, call the information, get his phone number? And I did. He was up in Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. So I called him in the summer and told him where he was at, that I had all my material ready, I needed some kind of guiding central theme. Could he give me some hints? He says, well, that's not my job, son. You just want to figure that out on your own. And I tried one more time. I said, well, can you give me any direction to go with because of your experience? He goes, no, I can't. So, bang. The way I had it done. And I've still read his books and read the 50s and used his words. So that's my feeling of David Halberstam.
But it's
so when he died a couple of days
now,
ago.
Now, wait.
It's not bad, you know, that I feel this.
Okay, wait. I have some... Just insult... Anyway, okay. Now,
maybe he's talking about me.
No. Isn't there a Buddhist belief where you? Isn't there a Buddhist belief where you can't ask for the? You can ask any question. Like you can ask. You have to have a question, and they can give you an answer, but you can't ask them for just something. Isn't that a Buddhist belief?
That's a Zen belief. I'm not a Zen. Maybe I shouldn't hold a grudge like that. But I just thought to myself, it reminded me this. If anybody in the future ever asks me for help on something, make sure at least be polite enough to say, gee, I just don't know. I hope it goes out well for you. And if I can ever do something in the future, let me know. Wouldn't that have been a smoother way to be rejected? Yeah.
That's like Truman looking for a diplomat with Byron MacArthur.
It is.
I hate this recorder.
Look at these other cases in 148.
The recorder doesn't matter.
These cases do come up, so I won't go in great detail, but I'll talk a little bit about them. Baker versus Carr, 1962. These are all cases that Earl Warren presided over. In fact, the area that Earl Warren adjudicated over was civil rights cases, rights of the accused, and redistricting or reapportionment. What's the slang word for that?
Gerrymandering.
So gerrymandering cases, civil rights cases, and rights of the accused. Are the areas...
Well, you have a contraception case in that case.
Yeah, that doesn't fit the categories. That's a privacy case, really.
Yeah.
Which we're going to use in discussion 6P. So we were doing something 6P and I needed a privacy case besides Roe v. Wade.
It's Griswold versus Connecticut.
I forgot. But anyway, these are the areas that he, I guess, judicially, actively expanded the law. You know, speaking of judicial action, real quick. All the complaints about judicial activism is that judges are using the law to promote liberal causes by reading into the law what's not there. Well, that's probably true for the post-World War II, World War II 20th century. But another area of extremely powerful judicial activism is from the 1880s to the 1920s, when the court reads everywhere it can in the law how to protect corporations and businesses and keep them from being taxed on the property argument. So they did it then, it just got reversed. Baker versus Carr is this. This said that the courts have the authority to play a role in dictating redistricting. And there will be two other cases you do not have to know that follow up on it, in which the phrase one man, one vote comes. Where this is, the way to understand this is this. Let's do a hypothetical. Let's say Tennessee has how many? 9 electoral votes? I think it does. So that has 7 House seats. Okay. It'd be feasible to assume that Memphis by itself, maybe Knoxville by itself, and Nashville would have a seat apiece, right? Maybe even more. And then the remaining of those 7 seats would be out in the rural areas. Prior to this case, it was likely that the 5 or 6 of those seats would all be out of rural areas and one seat would take in Knoxville and Nashville and Memphis all together. What's so wrong about that?
The borders would connect or?
Mm-hmm. Well,
one seat goes to the areas that have a high minority population. And
yeah, well, I misread my image wrong, but what I was trying to say is that you'd have 1 million people in one district and maybe 30,000 in another.
Well,
so that gives advantage to whom?
To
the
No.
And most of the time, your rural people are going to be
white and
WASPy, where the inner city people tend to be more minority, especially African Americans. So the way that states allowed to their own resources redistrict each time, it's usually the party in power that does it, they gave preference to the white loaded areas and underrepresented the minority areas.
This is Baker v. Carr.
Baker v. Carr comes along, and in that case, Warren rules that the courts can compel states to redistrict according to one man, one vote equality.
Lots of people vote.
Not anymore, though. And not as much. And therefore, they must redistrict in such a way as to where the cities get more representation at the expense of the rural areas, which if you put that in race terms is who's going to gain seats?
The minorities.
That's why Warren argued that the Baker versus Warren case was the most important case of his administration, or his, what do you call it?
Tenure.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. That was the most important case because it instantly across America gave more representation to minorities.
Gerrymandering refers to like
that's
districts or county.
Redrawing districts. Usually gerrymandering means you redraw the districts to your own political advantage to keep your party in power. From 1947
right.
on to the 1960s, there was a very extreme right-wing organization called the John Birch Society.
Yeah.
In the 50s, the John Birch Society's big campaign and big billboards everywhere was impeach Earl Warren.
Yep.
Because of this issue.
Gideon versus Wainwright.
Gideon versus Wainwright is the case that involved...
Was this the dude sleeping in the pool hall? Or
well, he was accused of robbing a pool hall in Florida. He was innocent, but he was convicted. He never had a lawyer in trial. While in prison, he wrote in handwriting and pencil an appeal to Abe Fortas on the court saying because he never could afford or had access to a lawyer, he was denied his right to counsel. Now, that argument had been tried prior to this time and had always been rejected, but Abe Fortas was thinking about, he was rethinking that position on previous cases when he got the letter from Gideon. And he, through the writ of certiorari, called up the records of the case and they allowed him to be retried, arguing that his right to counsel had been denied because he couldn't afford one. And that established what precedent for the future.
That if
you are going to be in danger of serving time, then you never had a lawyer, then your right to counsel has been denied. That's rights of the accused. And of course, the most famous case at the end of the line here that's in the same area of rights of the accused is which one? Yeah, that at the time of arrest you have the right to be read your rights and remain silent, or otherwise you've been denied your due process.
Well,
was it Griswold?
Griswold versus Connecticut 65 involved a Planned Parenthood clinic which was giving out birth control advice, not devices, just advice to married couples. And the state of Connecticut had a law making it illegal for agencies to give out birth control advice. And so Planned Parenthood violated the law and went through the courts, and they won the case, and the Connecticut law was overturned because it violated adults' rights to privacy.
Isn't that free speech?
I would think so.
So what did they say was illegal?
What did the court finally deem? That on the grounds of privacy, that parents are... The parents can receive advice concerning contraception.
In this rule, it's known as standard connected business.
Mm. Yeah, that makes sense. Now back into my favorite area, foreign policy, 151. This is what I love.
Did Dulles do brainsmanship?
Yes, he sure did. John Foster Dulles became the Secretary of State for Eisenhower. And as I see him, I realize I've left somebody out of the story. So let me do a story about the late 40s, and then that'll make Dulles fall into place, making sense. The Truman approach to Stalin in Russia, very confrontational, very guarded, and on the advice of an ambassador to Russia, what's his name, Kennan, George F. Kennan? He proposed to Truman that America's policy should be to be on guard against Soviet expansionism, that they are territorial and they are dangerous, that you should engage in a containment policy. And so the Truman approach was, we can't let the Russians go any further. Any movement beyond the Iron Curtain will be deemed as a danger to all the world and be responded to with military action. But that was to hold them where they are. When Eisenhower is elected in the 50s, it's obvious that the Republicans want to make it look like Democrats have been soft on communism, and now that Republicans are in office, we'll be much tougher against communists. Well, the Secretary of State for Eisenhower, John Foster Dulles, from the airport Marine Corps.
It used to be.
Has it changed?
Ronald Reagan.
Dulles Airport.
Reagan National Airport. Every
day,
like, Susie died.
Anyway,
Dallas. Sorry to break the news.
And they're both Republicans.
Yeah, but what was the Dutch of much worse? One created the Depression of the 80s.
Dallas was very hawkish about the Soviet threat. And Dulles and Eisenhower together, but it's mainly Dulles, orchestrated a theme that said it's not enough just to contain the Russians. Containment is cowardly. Containment is accepting it. We should be engaged in rollback. We have a duty to liberate these countries east of the Iron Curtain who have been conquered by Soviet territorial expansionists. Well, that's pretty provocative stuff, to start claiming they're going to push the Russians back out of Eastern Europe. And in addition to his rollback campaign, he's remembered for making the phrase, this is he remembered more so for this phrase, that if necessary, we will go to the brink of war to stop the spread of the Soviets. And that gave rise to what was called brinkmanship policy. So containment is Truman in the 40s, brinkmanship is Dulles in the 50s under Eisenhower. In addition to the brinkmanship policy, Dulles went around trying to expand and build more alliances. NATO was strengthened, but there's also the creation of the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, SEATO, CETO.
Colin 157.
Okay, yeah, look at that.
What does brinkmanship mean?
Being willing to go to the brink of war to save the world from the Soviet spread. Think about it for a second. That may sound dangerously hawkish in the 50s, but it shouldn't surprise you, because that kind of thinking goes back to where? What should have been done with Hitler. If the original World War I allies had gone to the brink of war right at Austria or right at Sudetenland, there wouldn't have been a World War II.
Or right at moving troops past the Rhine.
Yeah, there wouldn't have been a World War II if they'd stood up to him then. And Republicans, by the way, were far more isolationist than Democrats in the 1920s and 30s. So there's probably a bit of guilt within the Republican Party is that we got tagged as the isolationist America First bunch before the war. We can show these Democrats how to be much tougher in communism.
What is he, but does that mean he can... He's been given the power of Brinkman?
As Secretary of State,
he can declare... I'm confused.
It's to make the claim that the U.S. will go to the brink of war to protect the world from Soviet expansionism is just a saber-rattling threat to the Soviets.
So Congress said he could say that?
Congress is in harmony with this. This
although
is a time period...
Say over it.
Yeah, but this is a time... All the complaints today about how those of Congress should be supporting the president go back to the day when before Vietnam or up until the debacle of Vietnam started to happen, there was such an entrenched bipartisanship between Congress and the presidency. That was true for the Korean War. It was true for the start of Vietnam. Are you okay?
I'm good.
So he built CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization. He also built ANZUS, a pact of Australia, New Zealand, and the United States. And there was an effort...
That seems really random. Australia, New Zealand.
Well,
it's not really.
It's to protect down the Southeast Asian area.
Australia from an attack from what?
Well, what I'm not saying is that communist revolutions in the late 40s and early 50s, which were eventually suppressed, were breaking out in Malaysia and the Philippines and Indonesia. All of those are brought under control. But at the time, late 40s, early 50s, China's gone communist. The Korean War has occurred, Malaysia, Indonesia. There is this fear that communists are moving in every third world place they can, so you've got to build a pack to stop it.
So there's still a large Filipino communist party?
The Hukbala Hoops.
Insane?
They're pretty insane.
Yeah, they're insane.
any communist movement that stays as fanatic as they are after Russia fell apart is pretty wild there.
So all these were organized by
this is Dulles' action.
Dulles still?
The Baghdad Pact, sometimes called METO, the Middle East Treaty Organization, and by the way, the CETO is sometimes called the Manila Pact. But the Baghdad Pact was an attempt to try to line up Arab nations against the Russians, and that just didn't go.
They couldn't buy all their weapons from Russia?
Well, yeah, the reason it didn't go is because, well, you know, it'd be obvious. The Arabs are either wanted to be neutral or be pro-Russia because we were
pro-Israel.
As long as we were pro-Israel, it was hard to get Arabs. But we were trying to get Arabs and Israelis all on our side. If you think about it, NATO, METO, CETO, ANZUS, the buildup of having hydrogen bombs and bomber planes. If you were Russian, how would you feel?
Well, we've got enemies surrounding us now.
Yeah, I mean, we've been invaded twice in this century and lost some 40 million altogether, and now there's another capitalist threat coming from America. So I think both powers, to be fair, both powers were scared to death of each other, and both powers did threaten each other, even though each blamed the other.
You can kind of see some of the Arab sentiment towards the U.S. and the Soviet Union, in that the Mujahideen people, the fanatics, called the U.S. the Great Satan, and they called the Soviet Union the Lesser Satan.
That's true, yeah. We were the Greater Satan. What about 152? Have we talked about the Balfour Declaration and the creation of Israel? This is important stuff, even if it wasn't on the AP test. This is important for knowing what's going on in the world.
Is it still going on?
Yeah. It has a World War I origin to it.
Continue, sir.
Thanks. During World War I, 1917, the British foreign minister, somebody Balfour, David Alfred, somebody did Balfour.
David.
I think it's David. Although he could be in Treasure Island.
What kind of minister?
I don't think so.
Prime Minister?
Isn't David Balfour in Treasure Island? A kidnapped or something? Anyway, the Balfour Declaration of 1917 declared that a homeland for Jewish people will be established in Palestine.
We've talked about this.
Yeah.
Why was it done?
Because of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
What year was this?
Hadn't happened yet.
This 1917.
Yeah.
It's like the Flanagan explanation. What was it?
Something about Bush was elected because of 9/11.
Yeah.
He was re-elected.
That's Kenneth
Flanagan. I hope he listens to this.
He will. He did correct himself quite quickly. But the purpose behind the Balfour Declaration was to try to get Jewish money in New York and in London to support World War I. They'd made the comment that they could mobilize more resources for this war if there was chance for Zionism to really have a root in the Middle East.
That sounds like the best place for it, though.
Well, that's their historic homeland, is what they want. They wanted to return after all that long
diaspora.
But at the same time that this is being done, this is where it gets complicated. Britain said to the Arab resistance fighters trying to break free from the Turkish Empire that if you'll help us fight and defeat Turkey in World War I, we will give you sovereignty over your land. So they're offering the same land to two different groups.
No, America did Balfour.
No, we didn't do this.
British.
This is Britain.
No, Britain's doing both.
This is Britain stuff, yeah.
The Britain's the people that own
the Middle East. We're
still, at this point, I guess we're almost in the war yet, but we're still being pretty anti-war by 1917.
Britain kind of owns the Middle East right now? Or kind of after World War I,
it's
start owning
the mandate colonies of Versailles come after this. Well, what happens is they win the war. Now they've got to deliver either to Jewish people or Arab people. What do?
They split it up.
None.
Neither. They keep it as a mandate colony from 1919, following Versailles, all the way to World War II. The Holocaust does occur. In the 20s, some Jewish people moved in, but in not numbers that were large enough to shock or frighten the Arab population. But there is that steady blockbusting thing we're talking about taking place where Jewish money is buying off Arab homes and taking over communities. But they're all finding their place where they can live. But after the Holocaust occurs in 45, 46, and 47, large amounts of Jewish people from all over the world, from almost all that are left of Europe, which is hardly none, are migrating to that area. And the British are supposed to keep them out because they're breaking immigration policies, but you can't stop Jewish people coming off landing crafts in the coast of the waters. You'd look like a Nazi. So the place fills up with large numbers of Jewish people.
And what place?
Palestine. And so, tension between the two communities grow. There are terrorists among the Arab community and the Jewish community attacking each other and attacking the British, trying to get the British to leave. Actually, Jewish terrorists are fighting the British more than the Arabs. And eventually, in May of 1948, well, before we get to that, there are a couple of partition plans proposed in the United Nations. One is not accepted by both. One is not accepted by the Arabs. They should have took it, but they can't. And then on May 14th, 1948, the British just said, our mandate control of this colony is over. We hereby quit. I'm leaving.
God. Did they say they were giving it to? Or
no, they said, we're just the hell out of here.
I'm done.
We tried the UN to solve it. We're gone.
Whoever catches it.
And on that same day, Jewish leaders declared the sovereign state of Israel. And on that same day, every surrounding Arab nation declared war on Israel and invaded.
Don't they do that about every 20 years or so?
The first of, say, four, but maybe five major wars. Here's the Arab-Israeli wars that have occurred, the one in 1948 and 49, the one involving the Suez Crisis of 56, the Six-Day War of 67, which is the one that added so much land. In 1967, Israel took over West Bank of the Jordan River, Gaza Strip of Egypt, Golan Heights of Syria, and in so doing in 1967, they took in a large number of Arab populations within the Jewish border, which became the Palestinian population from which the Palestinian Liberation Organization arose. In 73, they fought Egypt. In 81, there was a struggle in southern Lebanon.
And then in 2006, there was another struggle.
And last summer, there was another struggle in southern Lebanon. So, and there's been numerous peace plans put forward. The one that will end up on the test, most logical, is the Camp David Accord of 1978. Receiving Nobel Peace Prizes in 79? No, 78, because Mother Teresa's 79. So 1978 was the Camp David Accord. That comes up on the test. Who negotiated the Camp David Accord?
Carter.
Who were the two people that received Nobel Peace Prizes for doing it? The Egyptian leader, Anwar el-Sadat, and the Israeli leader, Menachem Begin.
Begin?
Yeah, I don't think you'll need to know Begin and Sadat, but Carter did negotiate the Camp David Accord.
They both won. I think Carter won.
Carter doesn't get his till what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, he gets a lifetime achievement award.
That's a piece. But where this figures into American foreign policy is, we supported Israel within like a half hour of the declaration of Israel. Truman immediately acknowledged and recognized it. So you know where that shoves the Arabs. They're being shoved into the camp of the Russians.
Right.
It's not that they want to be Marxist, but they hate us for supporting Israel. And the reason Israel wins each of these wars is because both European and American money and guns keep them supported.
Do the Russians support the Arab nations?
They do, as much as they can. In the 73 war, after the 73 war, Arabs take revenge on us by doing what?
The barracks bombing in Beirut.
That's 83. 73, they boycott oil sales for half a year. And when they resume oil, that's when it starts to go through price-wise. That's the beginning of the
process. How high did it get?
I can remember it as being as bad as 90 cents a gallon.
Wow.
Hey, when it was 19 cents a gallon for cheap stuff and 35 cents for the fancy stuff, 90 cents a gallon was enormous.
Well, you also have to adjust that for inflation.
$3.
The inflationary 80s. Right now.
That's when my first year I taught school, I made $7,500 as a yearly salary in 1975.
And that's when you were trying to get money for graduate school?
Well, if you think about it, all this inflation happened in the 80s under Reagan, so before the 80s, $7,000 was a...
Well, the bigger inflation leap was in the Carter years. That's what caused him to lose the election. But in the Arab-Israeli thing, keep in mind that there is the constant problem. The Arabs being pro-Russian and the Israelis being with us. Why did Truman so quickly acknowledge the existence of Israel?
Pressure from Jewish organizations?
Yes. The Jewish voters in America were solidly Democratic Party members, and you couldn't risk the loss of Jewish voters in New England and Florida and elsewhere. If they ask more about the situation, I think the area where you get an AP question about is the Suez Crisis of 56. That's the one that you should really know about. And I can do a little quick synopsis of this, enough that you can get through a question. Gamal Abdel Nasser. Am I holding people too long?
No.
Gamal Abdel Nasser became the president of Egypt after he and a guy named Naguib shot and killed Farouk, didn't he? Yeah. I think in 52, when I was born, they shot and killed Farouk, and by 54, Nasser became the president of Egypt. And in 56, Nasser wanted to, what was it, he...
Nasser wants to
do it now? Yeah, before, he does it for a reason. What's the story on this? He wants to buy guns.
From the
Czech. And he wants to trade wheat, cotton, Nile-grown cotton, for guns so he can fight the Israelis. And... No, that's not where it goes. He wants to build a dam.
That's
what it is. He wants to build the Aswan High Dam to stop the Nile flooding. And to get the money to pay for the dam...
Wait, to stop the Nile flooding?
He's willing to trade...
Isn't that what water's...
Yeah, it does create the problems you anticipate. That which replenishes the soil stops happening after the dam's built. The dam's not built in 1975.
You don't have the yearly deposition.
Anyway, he wants to build the Aswan High Dam in 55. And he goes to both the Russians and the Americans for the loan to get the money. And what's his name? Fellas. Fellas wants to lend him the money so that the Egyptians will veer away from the Soviets and start being on our side. But then Dulles discovers, here's how the story's working out, discovers that he has traded Nile-grown cotton for Czech-made machine guns and never told Dulles about it. So Dulles gets furious and cuts off the offer of the loan. So Nasser, who had been told by Khrushchev, who's in power now after Stalin died in 53, been told by Khrushchev that don't take the American money, we'll give you the loan. So now that we've cut him off, Nasser goes to Khrushchev and says, I need the money. And Khrushchev says, we have no money. We just didn't want you to take money from us. So now he's mad at everybody. So that's why he nationalizes the Suez Canal. That's how the story came out. He nationalizes the Suez Canal to get the money in order to pay for the dam building. And with
when
he closes the canal, says this is Egyptian run.
And
oil.
And who owned the canal?
Britain.
Egypt officially owned it, but the British controlled it in the early days. So when the British now couldn't get through the canals, they said they're threatening to take over the canal. And Nasser says nobody's taking over the canal, so he wrecks ships and tree trunks and beer cans and everything, just fills up the canal area in the entranceway so nobody can use it. In response to that, the British and the French parachute onto the Sinai Peninsula to take over the canal, and while they're attacking, the Israelis say, how about a preemptive strike? They invade too. So the Israelis, the French, and the British paratroopers are all running over the Sinai Peninsula to take over the canal, and the Russians and the Americans, independent of each other, go to the United Nations and call for the withdrawal of all these troops, which happens. And at the same time, that's in 56, right around the same time that's happening, Hungarians want to rise up and revolt against Russian rule, and Dulles has sent the signal, anybody that rises up will be liberated through our rollback program. So when the Hungarians rise up, the Russians send the Russians send in tanks to crush the Hungarian revolt, and the Hungarians believe that we're going to be there to bail them out, and we're not. And so the revolt in Hungary is crushed mercilessly by the Soviets.
Well, why weren't we there?
And we expand for temporary our immigration program. And 12 years later, same thing happens in Czechoslovakia. They threaten to break free, and the Russians send tanks and crush that, and it's called Prague Spring.
God,
what's it?
This is Prague Spring. And this is what I grew up with all my life now. Born in 52 when the bombs were being made, hiding under the desk in the school. I tell you, Cuban Missile Crisis story. I tell you, which we'll come to a little later in 62, when the Russians put missiles in Cuba. The range of the missiles could reach is from Washington, D.C. all the way out to San Francisco within, they said, like, I think it was like 35 minutes or less that they could get
there. Oh, 35 minutes is from Russia.
Okay, then it was 17 minutes from Cuba, I think it was.
I think it's like 9 to Washington, D.C. from Cuba.
And I was in third grade, and I remember a music teacher took us to a music class and said, today we're not going to be singing, we're going to be practicing how to position ourselves under concrete areas. And we said, why? Third grade kids. I said, why? And she told the whole story about the missiles in Cuba. And we just learned about it. We don't know how many days we have to prepare for this. I had dreams all throughout my youth of mushroom clouds. Seeing the cloud and wondering, is it far enough away that it won't immediately find me? And then waking up. For years I had those dreams. As a child.
You know, a teacher told me Santa Claus wasn't real, and it really upset me. I don't know how I would handle that.
I can remember as a small kid one time I was with some friends, family in San Francisco, driving around the main streets at, what's that place, Union Square, and a car pulled up, and somebody said in the car, look, there's Russians in that car. And I turned around expecting literally to see pitchfork and tail. and they looked like just ordinary white folks. Which ones are the Russians? Which ones are the Russians? The ones in that car. And they didn't look like devils, and I couldn't figure it out. That's how I was raised to think as a kid. So you can't even begin to think how people my generation think about the fact that when Gorbachev and Reagan negotiated, and then finally the wall in Berlin was torn down, that couldn't happen. That's 200 years into the future before we even think about that. So I think I said some of the stuff on the sheet here. Yeah, 153. And 154 starts Vietnam.
Oh, God.
Are we out of time? Are you okay?
Vietnam tomorrow.
Okay. So we'll be doing the Vietnam story. And Vietnam could be an essay. It never has been, but it could be.
Vietnam hasn't been an essay?
Yeah.
It's
so recent, because it's so recent.
12:15 tomorrow?
One of the, 12:15. One of the questions that is often asked about Vietnam is this right here.
Let me show you this. I don't know why this gets asked a lot, but what was the path from North Vietnam through Laos down into South Vietnam, of which weapons and Viet Cong
something march? Maybe.
What's the name of this hidden trail throughout Laos?
Oh.
The Ho Chi Minh Trail.
That
comes up. That's a magical trail.
Much like.
Will anyone be taking the test in here? The AP test?
No, the AP test will be taken in the Indoor Activity Center.
Oh, no.
What?
You accidentally gave
AP test be taken in the.